creates that lawyer who best exemplifies, if you will, the tenets and meaning of our faith through the practice of his or her law or profession. We have many judges involved. It is named, of course, in honor of the martyred chancellor to King Henry VIII, who stood up as he wrested the church from Rome, the Church of England. These ideals of St. Thomas More, these ideals of morals and ethics in our society bring us to our featured speaker today. Professor George's background and biography, I invite all of you to take a look at those writings, at his works that are shown in our materials here today. And rather than go through those per se, I'd like to speak a little bit to what he brings to the table, what he brings to us today. Because indeed, it is the materials that we have in our program today, this leader, this educator, this writer, this living inspiration truly exemplifies what are the goals of this Bringing Home America Back to Life symposium. As one who has, as Molly noted, stood for public office, I can attest to the difficulties it is, in fact, facing those running for public office to maintain and walk that line of political morality and propriety in a world that often tries to pull us away. Professor George's work is dedicated to pulling us back. As the founder and director of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions, Professor George's work can be defined as communicating an appreciation of the blessings of the American founding and the principles of our Declaration of Independence. How more appropriate is it today that our speaker, Professor George, is that individual that is most responsible for reestablishing in our society, in our philosophical debate, the concept of natural law theory? It's a worthy political view as established through his analytical rigor that has brought it to the point and elevated it to an accessibility not seen and not previously understood. As we stand here today, then, we look at Professor George, his books and writings in the field, whether it's the Manhattan Declaration or his many other and powerful works that demonstrate the true clarion call to Christian conservative conscience. Where Christians, as it said, when living up to the highest ideals of this faith, of their faith, have defended the weak and vulnerable and worked tirelessly to protect and strengthen our vital institutions, beginning fundamentally with our families. This defense and projection of the sanctity of life, of traditional marriage, and of religious liberty is the foundation of Professor George's work. So please introduce me and join me in introducing that man who some have termed America's most influential conservative Christian thinker, Professor Robert George, to the podium as he addresses the very idea of conscience and the political obligations of citizens towards human life. Professor George, thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Craig. Thanks for that marvelous introduction. I am very impressed that you're the father of four daughters. Don't know if they're all spoken for, but I want to point out I have a bachelor son. You and I can talk later about that. He's a good guy. It's really great to be with you. I congratulate you, Molly, on the work of Cleveland Right to Life, and I congratulate all of you on the important work that you're contributing to. There is no cause greater than the defense of human life in all stages and conditions, and I honor you for being part of that cause. It's great to be here with my dear old friends, Ted and Sally Smith. They've worked with me and helped me in what I've been trying to do at Princeton with some of my colleagues there, and it's just so wonderful to be with them. And also wonderful to be with my dear friend, Star Parker. You're going to hear her tomorrow. All I have to say is you're in for a treat, and I'm glad I'm speaking ahead of her because no one can follow her. You're going to get really something special tomorrow from Star Parker. I was recruited into the pro-life movement by my mother, my dear mother, growing up in Morgantown, West Virginia, just across the border down there, when I was about 13 years old. It's been one of the great blessings in my life to be part of this movement, to be able to stand for the greatest of great causes. And among the blessings of being part of the pro-life movement over all these years has been the opportunity to work not only with my fellow Catholics, but with people from many different denominations and religious faiths. This movement crosses the historic lines of theological division and brings together evangelical Christians with faithful Catholics, Eastern Orthodox Christians, Latter-day Saints, observant Jews, increasingly people from other faiths. At Princeton, we had our annual Respect Life Sunday in the College Chapel. Can you believe that? We have Respect Life Sunday in the College Chapel at Princeton. We've got a very strong pro-life movement at Princeton. We took a delegation of 50 students this year down to the annual March for Life in Washington, D.C., and that was only a fraction of the students who would have gone had the timing been better. But this year at our big Respect Life service in the Princeton University Chapel, an inspiring speech was given by a great Muslim pro-life scholar, Hamza Yousef of the Zaytuna Seminary. So our movement is growing, it's crossing these theological divisions, and it's a great blessing to work with people of all the different faiths who share the commitment to the sanctity of life in all stages and in all conditions. Ordinarily, out of respect for that diversity, that theological diversity, I try to speak in the language of natural law, in a common philosophical idiom, in defending the life of the child in the womb, or the life of the frail elderly person, or the person suffering from a handicap or a disability. But today, if you will indulge me, I want to focus a bit more than I usually do on the Catholic witness to the pro-life cause and to address some questions that have come up in relation with that. I hope that what I say will be of interest to people of other faiths who are with us today, because I think that the issues I'm going to talk about also arise in the context of other religious traditions. The Catholic Church proclaims the principle that every human being, without regard to race or sex or ethnicity, and equally without regard to age or size or stage of development or condition of dependency, is entitled to the full and equal protection of the laws. That's a fundamental principle from the point of view of Catholic moral teaching. The Church teaches that human beings at every stage of development, including those at the embryonic and fetal stages, and those in every condition, including those who are mentally handicapped or physically disabled, and those who are suffering from severe dementias and other memory or mind-impairing afflictions, possess fundamental human rights. And above all, each of us possesses a right to life. Now, this teaching is, of course, disputed by some. That's why we have a pro-life movement. That teaching is not accepted by everybody. There are those, including some Catholics, who deny that human embryos are human beings. They assert that the human embryo is merely potential life, not nascent human life. Now, the trouble with this position is not theological, but rather is scientific. It flies into the face not of the Bible or the teaching of the patristic fathers or the tradition of the church so much as modern science. It flies in the face of modern science, especially the established facts as established by human embryology and developmental biology since the discovery of the ovum transformed our knowledge of human embryogenesis and intrauterine development in the 1820s. We know, as a matter of scientific fact, not as a matter of religious faith or theological speculation, as a matter of scientific fact, that a human embryo or fetus is not something distinct in kind from a human being, the way that, for example, a rock or a potato or an alligator is something different from a human being. No, a human embryo or fetus is a human being at a particular very early stage of development. A human embryo, even in the earliest stages, even prior to implantation in the uterus of the mother, is a whole distinct living member of the species Homo sapiens. Again, this is not something we know because we looked it up in Genesis or the Gospel of John. It's something we know from the unanimous testimony of every work of human embryology and developmental biology out there.
The folks on the other side have a problem, not because they've got religion wrong. They've got a problem because they're trying to fly into the face of the established facts of science, facts that they have to sweep under the rug if they are to defend the killing of the unborn. The embryonic human, each of us at the embryonic stage of our development, required only what any human being at any developmental stage requires for his or her survival, namely adequate nutrition and an environment sufficiently hospitable to sustain life. From the beginning, each human being possesses, and possesses actually and not merely, quote, potentially, unquote, the genetic constitution and the active disposition for self-directed development from the embryonic into and through the fetal, infant, child, and adolescent stages, and ultimately into adulthood with his or her distinctness, unity, determinateness, and identity fully intact. In this crucial respect, the embryo is quite unlike the gametes, that is, the sperm and the oocyte, whose union brought a new human being into existence by giving rise to the embryo. You and I were never sperm cells or oocytes. Those were genetically and functionally parts of other human beings. They were not new human beings. But each of us, and here's the central decisive fact in this whole debate, each of us was once an embryo, just as each of us was once an adolescent, and before that a child, and before that an infant, and before that a fetus. Each of us really did develop from the embryonic into and through the fetal, infant, child, and adolescent stages and into adulthood as the same individual organism, the same human being. Of course, in the embryonic and fetal stages, and in the infant stage for that matter, we were highly vulnerable and dependent creatures, but our rights don't depend on whether we're vulnerable and dependent. We were, despite our vulnerability, despite our dependency, distinct, complete human beings, not mere parts of other human beings. That notion from a scientific point of view is, and I'm sorry to use the word, but it's the only word available, really silly. The idea that the embryo or the developing fetus is part of the mother is just silly. What every work of human embryology and developmental biology makes clear is that the developing child in the womb, at whatever stage, is a distinct, complete member of the species Homo sapiens. As all the leading texts attest, we were not in the embryonic stage mere clumps of cells. You've heard people talk that way? Oh, that what's in the womb is a clump of cells? Nonsense. Nonsense not because the Bible says it's nonsense or the church says it's nonsense. The established facts of science say it's nonsense. We were never like moles or tumors, but we really were embryos, human beings in the embryonic stage of development. So the basic rights that people possess by virtue of their humanity, what people call human rights, and everybody claims to be for them, right? Have you ever met anybody who says, oh, I'm against human rights? Everybody says, I'm for human rights. Well, you get human rights when you become a human being. When do you become a human being? When do you get the right to life? When you come to be. And for humans, we come to be as embryos. We come to be in the embryonic stage. So the rights we possess now, we possessed then. Now, another school of thought concedes that human embryos are human beings, but denies that all human beings are persons. There are, according to this school of thought, and I'm sure you've encountered it in your arguments, pre-personal and post-personal human beings, as well as severely handicapped or damaged human beings who they say are not and never will be and never were persons. Advocates of this view insist that human beings in the embryonic and fetal stages are not yet persons. They're human beings, to be sure. That's a matter of biological fact. People who make this argument don't run away from the facts, but they distinguish human being from persons and say that not all human beings are persons. To be a person requires that we be more than merely a human being. Indeed, logically consistent and unsentimental proponents of this view say that even human infants are not yet human beings and therefore do not possess a right to life. Hence the willingness of my Princeton colleague, Professor Peter Singer, or Professor Michael Tooley of the University of Colorado and others to countenance infanticide as well as abortion. Permanently comatose or severely mentally handicapped or demented human beings are also denied the status of persons under this view. So euthanasia is said to be justified for human beings in these conditions. Now, although some who think along these lines will allow that human individuals whom they regard as not yet persons deserve a certain limited respect by virtue of the purely biological fact that they are living members of the human species, they nevertheless insist that pre-personal human beings do not possess a right to life that precludes them from being killed to benefit others or to advance the interests of society at large. Only those human beings who have achieved and retain what are regarded as the defining attributes of personhood, whether those are considered to be self-consciousness or a certain level of awareness or detectable brain function or something like that, possess a right to life. Now, the trouble with this second position is that it makes nonsense of our political, philosophical, and for many of us, theological commitment to the principle that all human beings are equal in fundamental worth and dignity, the cherished principle that is at the heart of the American proposition. As stated famously in our Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these is the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The view that denies that generates puzzles that simply cannot be resolved, such as the puzzle as to why this or that accidental quality, which most human beings eventually acquire, like rationality, in the course of normal development, but others do not, and which some retain and others lose, our rationality can come and go, and which some people have to a greater degree than others, should count as the criterion of personhood. The choice of the criterion that defines you as a person, once you've distinguished human being from person, is in the end always arbitrary. No conclusive, no sound argument can be given for choosing this criterion, rather than that one. So the superior position, it seems clear to me, is that human beings possess equality and intrinsic dignity that's the moral ground of the equal right to life of all. This is a right possessed by every human being simply by virtue of his or her humanity. It doesn't depend on an individual's age or size or the stage of development at which they happen to be at the moment, whether it's the fetal stage, the infant stage, the adolescent stage, nor can it be erased by an individual's physical or mental infirmity or condition of dependency. It's what makes the life, even of a severely mentally handicapped child, equal in fundamental worth to the life of a Nobel Prize-winning scientist or a great athlete. It explains why we may not licitly extract transplantable organs from such a child, even to save the life of a brilliant physicist or an NBA star who's threatened with a life-threatening heart or liver or kidney ailment. In any event, the position that all human beings equally possess fundamental human rights and dignity, including the right to life, is the definitively settled teaching of the Catholic Church, not just the Catholic Church. The same principles held by many evangelicals, Eastern Orthodox, Latter-day Saints, Jews, Muslims, and so forth. But it's certainly the definitively held teaching of the Catholic Church. And it's on this basis that the Church proclaims that the taking of human life in abortion, infanticide, embryo-destructive research, euthanasia, terrorism, are always and everywhere gravely wrong. They're not just wrong most of the time. They're wrong in principle, wrong all of the time. And there's more. For the Church also teaches that it is the solemn obligation of legislators and other public officials, as servants of the common good, to honor and protect the rights of all. The principle of equality demands, as a matter of strict justice, that protection against lethal violence be extended by every political community to all who are within that community's jurisdiction. Those to whom the care of the community is entrusted, above all those who participate in the making of the community's laws, certainly that means legislators, but in a democracy, that also means all of us, since at least indirectly all of us participate in the making of our community's laws, have the responsibility to ensure that the right to life is embodied in laws and effectively protected in practice. That's our duty. Now notice, by the way, that the obligation of the public official, on Catholicism's own self-understanding, is not to enforce the teachings of the Catholic Church. If you think that, you don't get it. It is rather to fulfill the demands of justice and the common good in light of the principle of the inherent and equal worth and dignity of every member of the human family. That's the principle. Yet today, many Catholic politicians and other politicians who proclaim themselves to be people of faith are staunch supporters of what they refer to as a woman's right to abortion. Most of these politicians also support the creation and government funding of a vast industry that would produce literally tens of thousands of human embryos by cloning for use in biomedical research, in which those embryonic human beings would be destroyed. That's what this battle over embryonic stem cell research, embryo destructive research, is ultimately all about: the cloning of human beings to be destroyed in the embryonic stage for biomedical research. Catholic politicians in the United States and in other nations who support abortion and embryo destructive research typically claim to be, and you've heard this so many times, haven't you, personally opposed to abortion. Have you heard that? Personally opposed. Oh, yeah. No, I'm pro-choice, but you know, be reassured. You don't have to worry about me because I'm personally opposed to abortion. They claim that despite their personal opposition, however, they have to be respectful of the rights of others who disagree to act on their own judgments of conscience without legal interference. Former New York Governor Mario Cuomo famously articulated and defended this view in a speech at the University of Notre Dame in 1984. Recently, Cuomo revisited the issue, or more recently, revisited the issue, speaking in Washington at a forum on faith and politics in America. Cuomo offered an argument there which, if successful, not only justifies Catholic politicians in supporting legal abortion and embryo destructive research, but actually requires them to respect a right of people to engage in these practices despite their admitted moral wrongness. If Cuomo's right, then the whole of Catholic teaching needs to be turned on its head. Cuomo asserted that the holders of public office, including Catholic office holders, have a responsibility, and let me quote him here so I'm not putting words in his mouth, quote, to create conditions under which all citizens are reasonably free to act according to their own religious beliefs, even when those acts conflict with Roman Catholic dogma regarding divorce, birth control, abortion, stem cell research, and even the existence of God, quotation mark. Now, according to Cuomo, Catholics should support, not oppose, support legal abortion and even its public funding, and embryo destructive research and its public funding, as he himself does, because, here's his argument, in guaranteeing these rights to others, we guarantee our own right to, quote, reject abortions and to refuse to participate in or contribute to removing stem cells from embryos, unquote. But I want to put it to you that Cuomo's idea that the right to reject abortion and embryo destructive experimentation entails a right of others, as a matter of religious liberty, to engage in these practices is simply, if spectacularly, fallacious. The fallacy will come into view for you immediately if you focus on the question whether the right of a Catholic or Baptist or Jew or member of any other faith to reject, say, infanticide or slavery or the exploitation of labor entails a right of others who happen not to share these religious convictions to kill, to enslave, and to exploit. By the simple expedient of classifying pro-life convictions, but only pro-life convictions, not convictions about slavery or the exploitation of labor, as, quote, Roman Catholic dogmas, unquote, Cuomo smuggles into the premises of his argument the controversial conclusion he set out to prove. If pro-life principles were indeed merely dogmatic teachings, such as the teaching that Jesus of Nazareth is the only begotten Son of God, then according to the Church herself, not to mention American constitutional law and the law of many other republics, they could not legitimately be enforced by the coercive power of the state. The Church firmly embraces the robust conception of religious liberty. That was the teaching of Dignitatis Humanae of the Second Vatican Council. The trouble for Cuomo and for all of the politicians who want to take his line is that pro-life principles are not mere matters of dogma, nor are they understood as such by the Catholic Church, whose beliefs Cuomo claims to affirm, or by pro-life citizens, whether they happen to be Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, agnostics, or atheists. Rather, pro-life citizens understand these principles and propose them to their fellow citizens as fundamental norms of justice and human rights that can be understood and affirmed even apart from claims of revelation and religious authority. The whole case against abortion, against embryo-destructive research, against euthanasia, or to put it positively, as we should more often, the whole case for the defense of human life in all stages and conditions, from the embryonic to the frail elderly person, can fully be made on the basis of the established facts of science, which so often the other side is forced to deny, and basic shared philosophical principles that can be grasped as a matter of our common human reason. They're not mere matters of religious dogma. Cuomo's trying to win the argument by falsifying that truth. It will not do, as Cuomo seems to suggest, to claim that the sheer fact that the Catholic Church or some other religious body has a teaching against these practices, and that some or even many people reject this teaching, means that laws prohibiting the killing of human beings in the embryonic and fetal stages violate the right to freedom of religion of those who happen not to accept the teaching. If that were anything other than a fallacy, then laws against killing infants, owning slaves, exploiting workers, and many other grave forms of injustice condemned by the Church and by many other religious organizations would be violations of religious freedom. Surely Cuomo would not wish to endorse that conclusion. Yet he provides no reason to distinguish those acts or practices putatively falling within the category of religious freedom, because they're matters of religious dogma, from those falling outside it. So we must ask, if abortion is immunized against legal restriction on the ground that it is a matter of religious belief, how can it be that slavery is not so immunized? If today abortion cannot be prohibited without violating the right to religious freedom of people whose religions do not object to abortion, how can Cuomo say that the prohibition of slavery by the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution in 1866 did not violate the right to religious freedom of those in the 19th century whose religions did not condemn slaveholding? Sure, matter of historical fact, that many religious groups, including many Christian groups, taught that slavery was morally acceptable, even sanctioned by the Bible. Cuomo says that the Catholic Church, quote, understands that our public morality depends on a consensus view of right or wrong, quote, unquote. But it would be scandalous to argue that Catholics should have opposed a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery in the 19th century or legislation protecting the civil rights of the oppressed descendants of slaves in the mid-20th century on the ground that prudence or realism requires respect for moral pluralism where there's no, quote, consensus, unquote, on questions of right or wrong. Why suddenly does Cuomo demand that we legislate only when we have a consensus when the issue turns to abortion or embryo destructive research? He's willing to legislate on everything else. So are all the rest of these politicians in the absence of anything even remotely resembling a consensus. How about let's just have one standard? Where do these double standards come from? At one point in the Forum on Faith and Politics, Cuomo suggested that laws against abortion and embryo destructive research would force people who do not object to such things to practice the religion of people who do object. But this is yet another fallacy. What I sometimes call a Cuomological fallacy. No one imagines that the constitutional prohibition of slavery forced those who believed in slaveholding to practice the religion of those who didn't. Would Cuomo have us suppose that laws protecting workers against what he, in line with the solemn teaching of every pope from Leo XIII to Benedict XVI, considers to be the exploitation and abuse of labor, have the effect of forcing non-Catholic factory owners to practice Catholicism? No. When Cuomo and the other politicians who claim to be personally opposed to abortion but pro-choice go out of their way to support what they regard as worker protection legislation, they don't seem to have any problem with, quote, imposing their religion on other people, despite the fact that what they're doing, they themselves would claim, is fully in line with Catholic teaching. Again, a glaring, spectacular double standard. But we're not supposed to notice. These guys think we're dumb. At another point, in denying that there was any inconsistency between his willingness as governor to act on his anti-death penalty views, but not on his anti-abortion views, notice, by the way, in the absence of any consensus about the death penalty, Cuomo denied ever having spoken against the death penalty as a, quote, moral issue, unquote. Okay? He says, I've never spoken, or very seldom spoken, about the death penalty as a moral issue. He claimed, in fact, that he seldom talks in terms of moral issues at all, and that when he speaks of the death penalty, he doesn't suggest or consider that it's a moral issue. Then, in the very next sentence, are you ready for this, Father? He condemned the death penalty in the most explicitly, indeed flamboyantly, moralistic terms. Here's what he said. Quote, I am against the death penalty because I think it is bad and unfair. It is debasing. It is degenerate. It kills innocent people, unquote. Oh, no moralizing there. He didn't even pause to consider that these are precisely the claims made by pro-life citizens against the policy of legal abortion and its public funding, a policy that Cuomo defends in the name of religious liberty. Yeah, we think it's bad. We think it's debasing. We think it kills innocent people. Now, that looks to me like a moral judgment, one that I'm happy to make, the way I'm happy to make the judgment that slavery is bad, that it's exploitative, that it's debasing, that it's degrading. But if you don't want to call that a moral judgment, fine with me. As long as we can agree that killing of innocent human beings in any stage, in any condition, is bad, debasing, a violation of human rights. Now, the fact is that Catholics and others who oppose abortion and embryo destructive research oppose these practices for the same reasons we oppose postnatal homicide. Pro-life citizens of every faith oppose these practices because they involve the deliberate killing of innocent human beings, members of the human family. Our ground for supporting the legal prohibition of abortion and embryo destructive research is the same ground, precisely the same ground, on which we support the legal prohibition of infanticide, for example, or the principle of non-combatant immunity, even in justified wars. We subscribe to the proposition that all human beings are equal in worth and dignity and cannot be denied the right to protection against lethal violence on the basis of age or size or stage of development or condition of dependency. It's on that ground that we honor the life of every member of the human family. One cannot, with moral integrity, be, quote, personally opposed, unquote, to abortion, yet support its legal permission and its public funding, as so many Catholic politicians do, including most Catholic Democrats and some Catholic Republicans in the United States. For by supporting abortion and embryo-destructive research, they unavoidably implicate themselves in the grave injustice of the practices. They try to stand aloof. I'm personally opposed. I'm just respecting people's rights. Those abortions that happen aren't my fault. Somebody else exercising her freedom, or the scientist exercising his freedom to create and destroy embryos. Now, let's see about how good that argument is. I think I can show you it's no good at all. Of course, it's possible for a person wielding public power to use that power to establish or preserve a legal right to abortion, for example, while at the same time hoping, as a matter of his psychology, he's hoping that no one will exercise that right. I don't doubt that Cuomo would prefer it if no woman exercised the right to abortion. But this does not get the person, such a person, off the hook, off the moral hook. For someone who acts to protect the killing of the unborn, to protect legal abortion, necessarily wills that abortion's unborn victims be denied the elementary protections of the law that one favors for oneself and for those one deems to be worthy of the law's protections. Thus, one violates the most basic precept of normative social and political theory, the golden rule: do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. If you wish to be protected by the law, if you wish your family to be protected by the law, then you must also act to make sure that everyone else, everyone else's family, everyone else's children are protected by the law. To do otherwise, even if one hopes that killing won't take place, but one is authorizing it legally, one divides humanity into two classes: those whom one is willing to admit to the community of the commonly protected, and those whom one wills to be excluded from it. And no matter how much you hope that no one will have an abortion, or people won't exercise this right you're protecting to destroy embryos, you are responsible, by virtue of your vote, your support, if you're one of these personally opposed people, you're responsible for excluding them from the community that you want to belong to, the community of the commonly protected, those who get the benefit of the law's protections. Now, there's something just fundamentally in violation of the principle of equality at the heart of our civilization when you divide the world up into two classes of people: those who get the protection and those who are denied it. By exposing members of the disfavored class, be they the unborn, the mentally infirm, whoever they are, to lethal violence, one deeply, unavoidably, deeply implicates oneself, however much one would like to stand aloof, in the injustice of killing them. You may not be driving a woman to the clinic. You may not be wielding the knife or the suction machine. But you have deeply, unavoidably implicated yourself in the killing when you have denied the victims protection against it. And so we can show with a high degree of analytical rigor, we can make a tight, conclusive argument to show that the so-called personally opposed position is simply untenable. Not untenable because the Bible is against it or the church is against it. Untenable because it fails the elementary test of logic. The goodness of whatever one hopes for, even if one hopes that the killing doesn't happen, the goodness of what one hopes for simply cannot redeem the evil of what one wills, the grave injustice of exposing other people to lethal violence. And to suppose otherwise is to commit yet another fallacy. Well, if my analysis so far is correct, the question arises, certainly in the Catholic Church, but I suspect in other religious communities as well. What should the leaders of the church do about people like Cuomo and his successor as New York's governor, Republican George Pataki, and now his successor, the Governor Cuomo's own son, Andrew Cuomo, who evidently take the same position? And there are many, many others, of course. What should they do about those who claim to be in full communion with the church, yet promote gravely unjust and scandalous policies that expose the unborn to the violence and injustice of abortion? Well, you'll all recall, except maybe some of the youngest of you out there, you'll all recall that in the run-up to the 2004 American presidential election, then St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke, now Cardinal Burke, offered an answer. Archbishop Burke declared that public officials who support abortion and other unjust attacks against innocent human life may not be admitted to Holy Communion in his diocese, in his archdiocese. Holy Communion, the Eucharist being this preeminent sacrament of unity in the church. Pro-life citizens across the religious spectrum, not just Catholics, applauded Archbishop Burke's stand. Critics, however, were quick to condemn the Archbishop. I'll bet you remember the criticisms. The newspapers were filled with them. The editorial pages were railing against Archbishop Burke. Do you remember? Am I? Yeah, okay. They denounced him, you'll recall, for, quote, crossing the line. Remember this? Crossing the line, separating church and state, putting the whole constitutional system in peril. But this is silly. Again, I'm sorry, there's not another word for it. In acting on his authority as a bishop to discipline members of his flock who commit what the church teaches are grave injustices against innocent human beings, Archbishop Burke was exercising his own constitutional right to the free exercise of religion. He was not depriving others of their rights. People have to remember, freedom, including religious freedom, is a two-way street, works in both directions. No one in the United States of America is compelled by law to accept ecclesiastical authority of any type. It's a free country. But Archbishop Burke and anyone else in the United States of America or other freedom-respecting nations has every right to exercise spiritual authority over anyone who chooses to accept it. There's a name for people who do accept the authority of Catholic bishops. They're called Catholics. Now, in many cases, the charge that Archbishop Burke and other bishops who adopt a policy of excluding pro-abortion politicians from communion are, quote, crossing the line separating church and state, unquote, is hypocritical. And I think we need to call the hypocrites on their hypocrisy. A good example of just this hypocrisy comes from my home state of New Jersey, where one of the prominent papers, the Bergen Record, decided that it would weigh into the controversy as it presented itself in my state. John Smith, the bishop then of Trenton, my own diocese, did not go as far as Raymond Burke in St. Louis had gone in forbidding prohibition Catholic politicians from receiving communion. Bishop Smith did, however, in the words of the Bergen Record, publicly lash Governor James McGreevy, a pro-abortion Catholic at the time, for his support of abortion and embryo-destructive research. Now, for criticizing the governor on these grounds, the Record, the paper, the newspaper, the Bergen Record, lashed the bishop in an editorial, one of literally hundreds around the nation. The newspaper accused the bishop of jeopardizing the delicate balance of our constitutional structure, contrasting Bishop Smith's position unfavorably with President John F. Kennedy's assurance to a group of Protestant ministers in Houston in 1960 that he, as a Catholic, would not govern the nation by appeal to his Catholic religious beliefs. Well, since the Bergen Record had seen to take us seen fit to take us back to 1960 for guidance, I thought I would invite its editors to consider a case that had arisen only a few years before that, in the 1950s. In a letter to the editor, I proposed a question that would enable the readers of the newspaper to determine immediately whether the editors of the Bergen Record were persons of strict high principle or mere hypocrites. I reminded readers that in the 1950s, in the midst of the political conflict over segregation, then Archbishop of New Orleans Joseph Rummel publicly informed Catholics that support for racial segregation was incompatible with Catholic teaching on the inherent dignity and equal rights of all human beings. Archbishop Rummel said that, and I quote him, "racial segregation is morally wrong and sinful because it is a denial of the unity and solidarity of the human race as conceived by God in the creation of Adam and Eve," unquote. The bishop then warned Catholic public officials that support for segregation placed their immortal souls in peril. Indeed, Rummel took the step of excommunicating, gone farther than Archbishop Burke went, excommunicating Leander Perez, one of the most powerful political bosses in Louisiana, and two other segregationist Catholic politicians who promoted legislation designed to impede desegregation in diocesan schools. So I asked the editors of the Bergen Record in my letter, was Archbishop Rummel wrong? Or do Catholic bishops cross the line and jeopardize the delicate constitutional balance only when their rebukes to politicians contradict the views of the editors of the Bergen Record? To their credit, the editors published my letter, but I am still waiting for their reply to my position. It's now approaching 7 years. I wish to remind some of you who probably don't read the Bergen Record, but read the paper that advertises itself as the paper of record for our nation, the New York Times, that in scolding the bishops, the Bergen Record was far from alone, because the Times immediately piled on, insisting that separation of church and state means that no religious leader, here's their language, no religious leader may presume to tell public officials what their positions may and may not be on matters of public policy. But of course, if we shift the issue, shift the focus from abortion to, say, genocide or slavery or the exploitation of labor or racial segregation, we see just how implausible such a view is. When Archbishop Rummel excommunicated those segregationist politicians in the 1950s, what did the New York Times say? It occurred to me to go back and look. Far from condemning the Archbishop publicly for publicly excommunicating these racist politicians for their positions on matters of public policy, far from condemning the Archbishop, they praised him for a great act of prophecy and courage. The editors of the New York Times were right then. They are wrong.
Professor George, don't you think part of the problem, as you expressed the issue of who is a human being, it's all a problem of definition. And it's a problem of definition of who's a human being, who's a Catholic, and who's a Catholic university. For example, I think you're saying we have human beings from the moment of conception. We have people who, more like Mario Cuomo, who say they're Catholics, but they're not. And we have universities like Notre Dame who say they're Catholic, but they're not. And so I'd like to say the problem seems to be of definition all the time. And then what to do about it once you've defined something.
Well, definitions are not arbitrary. They are human constructions, but they're not arbitrary human constructions. If definitions were arbitrary human constructions, then science simply couldn't proceed.
whether we're speaking of science in the modern use of the term, denoting the natural sciences, or science more broadly, intellectual inquiry. Definitions need to be justified. And if we look at the science itself, beginning with the discovery of the ovum in the 1820s. Now, prior to that, of course, we were in a situation that can only be described as speculative. We could do better and we could do worse. But since we really didn't know the elementary facts of conception, fertilization, the elementary facts of human embryogenesis, you have a high degree of speculation. And so you see some of the classical writers, some of the medieval thinkers, with different kinds of speculation about when you actually have a human being. And you have different religious traditions or elements of religious traditions proposing various hypotheses. Well, maybe you don't actually have a human being until 40 days after conception, or whatever equivalent they had in mind of conception in those days. But beginning with the discovery of the ovum in the 1820s, we began to uncover the facts. And the definitions that we're able now to use are definitions that are rooted in the facts and can be justified by inquiry, by understanding, by judgment, according to the methods of science, the tried and true, time-tested methods of scientific discovery. And that's why, whatever it may say in a legal opinion like Roe versus Wade, whatever some polemical writer might say in an op-ed column, the elementary texts, the texts that are used in American anatomy and medicine, there are several of them. There's the embryology text by Ronan O'Rahilly and Fabiola Mueller. There's the text by Moore and Persaud. There's a text by Larson. There's a text by Carlson. Those texts do not propose a whole bunch of different views as to when the life of a new human being begins. Their testimony is unanimous. And the testimony is unanimous not because they happen to be of the same religion. They're not. It's not because they have the same philosophical views or even the same views about abortion as a moral issue. The testimony is unanimous because the facts are the facts. And facts, as someone once famously said, are a stubborn thing. So in these debates, I'm really kind of not interested in arguing theology with people. I just want to hold people's feet to the fire of the facts. I'm not, I'd love it if they'd read the Bible more. That'd be great. But what I really want them to read is O'Rahilly and Mueller or Moore and Persaud or Carlson or Larson or any of the basic texts in human embryology and developmental biology. There's just no way out of this for the folks on the other side. That's why those who are really attentive, sharp, and willing to state what they believe is true, regardless of the political consequences, people like my colleague Peter Singer, that's why they never say that the developing human being, the fetus, they never say the fetus is not a human being. Ask Peter Singer whether the fetus is a human being. He'll give you the right answer. Of course the fetus is a human being. They want to make the argument the only place that it can be made once you accept the facts of science, which are there staring you in the face, and that is, well, okay, I've got to concede it's a human being, but not all human beings are persons. So they're willing to give up the principle of human equality to defend abortion. A principle that will lead to the justification of infanticide, which Singer is willing to embrace, and euthanasia and so forth. They're willing to bite the bullet and go there in order to protect abortion because they know that they cannot, with integrity and really in the end even with plausibility, make the absurd argument that what's growing in the womb is a potato or a fish or something other than a human being. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Professor. My name is Joseph Meisner. I'm an attorney. I've been with Lawyers for Life for about 40 years.
Bless you.
My question is this. I do not believe that the unborn child from conception onwards is a human being or deserves protection of the right to life. I'm convinced that that unborn child deserves the protection. Now, if, for example, I should get angry with you in this debate and I shot you, I think you would expect that there ought to be some consequences and I should be prosecuted. The hardest question I get from the other side is this. What are you going to do with a woman who, after we get protections of the right to life of unborn children, what are you going to do with a woman who has an abortion? Are you going to send her to jail, is really the hard way they put it. Thank you.
No, I wouldn't support that. I think that our goal here is not to be punitive. Our goal here is to protect innocent human life. We have to do everything we can to do that. Now, I think we have to recognize that there are reasonable people of goodwill on the other side. That was also true in the case of slavery, by the way. As horrible, monstrous as the practice of slavery was, there were people of goodwill who, in the culture of slavery, just couldn't see their way clear to acknowledging what to us is perfectly clear. That is the basic dignity of the African person, who's equal to us in every way. So I have no desire to be punitive. I want to respect the fact that there are people, including reasonable people, people I deal with every day and have friendly relations with who disagree. I'm not so much interested in putting people in jail as I am in stopping the slaughter of abortion. Now, I know to do that, we have to make it against the law. If we fail to make it against the law, then we violate the basic equal protection rights of a whole class of our fellow human beings. But we can, it seems to me, make it against the law. We can stop abortion in the overwhelming majority of cases without having harsh or punitive punishments or punishments against women in any way. It does seem to me true that women are so often, in so many different ways, the secondary victims of abortion. And, of course, they're having abortions in a social context in which our law itself has taught people for 40 years, the whole time you and I have been in this movement, has taught people that abortion's not killing. Abortion's not killing a human being. Now, I can understand in a culture whose very laws teach that, women are going to seek abortion sometimes. Or families are going to press women to have abortions, or boyfriends. Even employers will do that. When the law is teaching that it's not wrong, that it's not killing, I can understand why people will adopt the views they adopt. I regret it. I think it's horrible. But I can understand it. Just as in the old slavery system, with the law teaching people that the African human beings were secondary, they weren't equal, they weren't really fully persons, you can see why people would fall for that. It's what the law taught them. The law is a teacher. Go back to Aristotle. Aristotle noticed that thousands of years ago. The law teaches us. We form our judgments and our opinions in part in virtue of what the law is inculcating in us. So my goal is to fight abortion. It's not to punish women. And I think we can do that and should do that without punishing women.
Thank you very much for visiting.
Thank you.